This is the pedagogy of the non-poor, a form of social justice education, and Sister Marie Augustine Neal. Now, I would like to do this very informally today, because tomorrow I'm going to do more content, data-oriented sessions. I'm a sociologist, and you just can't work without data if you're a sociologist. But also, I'm a teacher, and I've been a teacher for a long time. And so I thought I'd give you a quiz. The quiz is going to have three items, and nobody has to see the answers but yourself. Now, over here on the wall is a map. And you can't see it very well, but if you could just shift around just to look at it. If you look at it very carefully, and then answer this question, is it different? Is there anything about it that's different from the maps that you are used to looking at in school, or in books that you're reading, or even on listening to the news at night? Now think of you, I'm going to ask three questions before I consider answers. All right, now the second one, and if you have a pencil, I'd like you to write this one down. And the question is, how many people are there in your community? This question doesn't allow for clarifications. How many people are there in your community? We're having a quiz, so you're supposed to answer these questions. And the third question is, which territories of the world are in most serious conflict, east, west, or north, south? You have to choose one or the other. It's a two-option question. All right, now we'll look back at the map. Now, some people said right away there isn't any difference in this map. And other people kind of looked kind of knowingly and said there was. So would somebody offer, if they see a difference, what difference they see?
The United States is not in the center.
That's right. The United States isn't in the center. Now the other two maps behind me, the United States isn't in the center, so you could say, see, it's just like every other map. However, in order to get this map to look this way, I had to cut it and paste it together again. There it is, right there. Now, I cut it because I thought it would hurt the ocean less than the land. So I cut it in the only place I could find a piece of ocean that went from the top to the bottom, and it happened to be off the coast of Alaska. And then I put it together again. I pasted it this way. I pasted it so the land mass would not be divided in any way. Because in order to put the United States in the middle, you have to cut the Soviet Union and China in half. And that's what we usually do. So we cut it right here, so that the Soviet Union is over here, and China's over here, and it's also over here. So you get the impression that you're surrounded by the Soviet Union and China, are surrounded by the communist world. And then if you think back for a long time, there's something else about this map that shows up this way that doesn't show up the other way. And that is, if you look at this empty space in Africa and the nose of Latin America, which is Brazil, and look at the curve of Africa and the curve of the Caribbean, and then if you look at this little missing piece in the top of Australia, and the little space here and the insert on the bottom of Southeast Asia. And then, if you're imaginative enough, you can see that Greenland could slip in here, and these little pieces could slip back here. If you keep looking at it, you say, oh, once upon a time, it was what? It was all one piece. So at one time, Whatever people, if there were people then, living on the face of the earth, we all lived on one big piece of land. So that when the American Indians were sitting on their land and they walked over from the steps of what is now the Soviet Union and down through Alaska and Canada and the United States and Central America, down through Latin America, they were really just walking on the same piece of land. On the other hand, you could think of them as if you had no, you know, real sense of history, that they all came from the Soviet Union. So what my point is that at one time in our life, in the life of the world, it was one landmass. And those of you that live in California, someday as you slip off into the ocean, and those who came from Italy and see that Italy slips down into the Mediterranean, you'll get the sense that on a certain day you just happen to be on one side of the landmass and on the other, and that's really what separates us. If that's the case, then how many people are there in our community?
4 billion.
Well, there's a few more. 4.5, you're close to it. 4.5 billion. Now, I want you to raise your hands. How many people put 4.5 billion? One, two, three. Well, we're getting there. So my argument is that there are 4.5 billion people in our community. So that when we talk about accepting our progeny, that is, the generations that are going to follow us, they can be people of any national group, racial group. It's just a chance of history that we happen to land on one landmass as distinct from another, or those who came before us and helped to shape and create who we are fall into those categories. Well, as a matter of fact, when we started our Christian teaching, that was the good news that came with the what we call the New Testament. That is, that we would be living in communities without walls, and that Yahweh, who was the God of a tribe, who discovered the one God experience, as distinct from the tribal gods that we read about in the Iliad and the Odyssey. One of the reasons why we didn't worry about what happens to people in other cities in those days, when I say we, I mean we people who live on earth. We didn't worry because our gods were taking care of us, and we had a sense of security. Well, their gods were taking care of them. If you remember when Aeneas picked up his father on his back and walked to Rome, he picked up his household gods also and took them with him. And if you have ever read Perrine's The Ancient City, you find that every city started with a city god, and no city started without a god. But there was a marvelous sense of security, because if every city had a god, then we, with our god, didn't have to worry about the folks with another god. But the good news was that we all had the same god. Now, the problem with that good news was that we taught it. We went out as missionaries, and we did a magnificent job. Now, I know we have a lot of criticism of our missionary endeavors of the 19th century, that we unwittingly, which is a nice Anglo-Saxon word, and it's appropriate that it be an Anglo-Saxon word, we unwittingly went to countries where our traders went, and we brought with our trading the gospel. But some of us, again, I'm speaking of us, we who live on earth, some of us could not clearly distinguish between our poets, our musicians, and our God. So we often brought our culture as well as our religion to those countries. So much so that I know when I went to rural Zimbabwe, I found out that in the little schools in the tribal areas, in order to pass the exams for secondary schools, you had to be able to quote Shakespeare. But you didn't have to know anything about Zimbabwean poets. Nobody even really thought of that, because you had to pass the Cambridge exams to get into the university. The world is falling down. Maybe that's appropriate. We'll leave it there. All right, well, in doing whatever we did, and with the limitations of what we did and all the mistakes we made, we taught the good news to the people we went to, that the land belongs to them. And they believed it, and it came with the gospel. And that was in the 19th century. In the 20th century, late 20th century, actually after 1950, we not only taught them that the land belongs to them, but we had begun teaching them about their human rights, which are very gospel-derived, as we will see from several of our sessions this week. And they believed that, too. And in the late 50s in Brazil, a method of teaching the poor using the gospel to reflect on and using the language of the gospel was invented in Northeast Brazil by a fellow whose name is Paulo Freire. Now, I know some of you know him. How many people know Paulo Freire? Know something about him? Look at all the plowshare people with their hands and a few others. Well, he published a book called The Pedagogy of the Poor. Of the Oppressed, excuse me. Thank you very much. Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And in it was a method of teaching people how to read and write. And the method was called the method of conscientization, a conscientização, which is a Portuguese word. And it meant raising to consciousness the political, economic, and social oppressions of your life and taking action to change those conditions. Now, many of us are familiar with consciousness-raising processes. This is not that. Because I can raise things to consciousness, to look at them, to be so horrified at them, that I can then develop, I can energize myself to develop psychic skills to so repress what I saw that the next time it comes around, I won't see it at all. And it will be the result of consciousness raising. But this word, this marvelous word, conscientização, means raising to consciousness the conditions and taking action to change them. The one word includes both processes. And that was the basis of his method of teaching literacy. Because many, many people in Northeast Brazil do not know how to read and write, even though the ability to do that has been available for Brazil for at least 150 years. Now, the idea is he would talk to the people in biblical reflection on the good news that the land belonged to them. And then he would ask them to apply that to the conditions of their own life situation. Now, and then they would learn to read and write in any place from 6 weeks to 6 months. Now, it sounds like a fairy story, and it does sound like one, and I didn't believe it. So, being a sociologist and a doubter by craft, I went to Northeast Brazil, and I went down into the interior, which is an interesting story in itself. I was going over the bridge the other day. You know the bridge that goes over the little stream, and it has four slats, and then the water's underneath, and the space between, you could easily trip down. I went out to Northeast Brazil to São Paulo. The poor in São Paulo, and that's a big city, it's right on the coast, live out or on over the ocean in the tidal areas because it's the untaxed land, it's the only land they can afford. And they have a bridge like that one going over the channel, but it's the bridge is as high as this room, and it's on posts that go down into the channel. But the slats are just like that, and there's no railing on either side. And their houses are out at the other end of it, and the bridge is about twice as long as this room. And I was going to visit people out there with a bag in one hand, and me expecting to take a plane the following Saturday. So I got halfway out, and I panicked, because I looked down, and it was very, very steep. And I looked ahead, and the people were all watching me coming across the bridge with one person in front of me and one behind. So I got over there, and the awful thought I had was, I had to get back. So by way of conversation, I said to somebody, do people ever fall through? Oh, they said, it happens all the time. That was one evidence of the fact that poor people risk their life every day. I had even worse experience than that during that week. But in any event, I was there because I didn't believe this worked and I wanted to find out. I found out that it did. I met with the villagers of 29 different villages coming together to look at a question. They had already learned how to read and write. They were not able to do it a year and a half before, but everybody in the village, the little children and the adults, they reflected on the Bible. They did a dialogue homily in the liturgy. They did the marriage preparation, the preparation for the other sacraments, the baptismal classes, and then they celebrated the liturgy outdoors. Now, in this setting, after the day was over, about 10 o'clock at night, till then, till 3 o'clock in the morning, they talked about the conditions of their town and what they were going to do about it. The problem, when I was there, was that the landowner would come and take the same, he took 50% of their produce anyway, and they signed an X before they learned how to read and write. Then he would come back again, regularly, each year this happened, and demand 50% again. And they would say, well, we already paid. And he said, no, you didn't. There's no evidence. So in between one set of comings, they learned how to read. And when he came and asked them for their X, they wrote their signature. And they asked for a copy of the contract. And he reported them to the local authorities as communists. And two of them were imprisoned. And then the people got together and said, what will we do? And the facilitator for the conscientization process was still there. And he said, well, it's against the law to do what he's doing. And they said, well, we don't know anything about the law. They said, well, let's use that next in the reading. And they learned that Brazilian laws are very just. They simply aren't used very often in the Northeast. So they learned the law, and they went down to the court to hear the case. Now, it was a military court at this time, because it was after 1964. The court then moved the case to the next state. And when I was there, what they were deliberating was how they would take care of the families of two of their members so they could send them to the next state to be present at the trial and so that they could go freely. And they did that, and I heard later they won the case. But what I said in my naivete is, you know, it's marvelous the way you people cooperate with each other, because they were people from the different villages they are planning. And they laughed at me and said, we never did this before. This is entirely new experience. We were competing for the same scarce goods. We were each other's enemy. We had no idea of the power of organization. So they were living in danger, but they had the organization. All right, now that I found an overwhelming experience. Now, why were they willing to talk to me? By the way, I don't speak Portuguese. I had one of our sisters translating, and she did it so easily and with them that people forgot I wasn't speaking their language, and I forgot that I wasn't either, because of the conversations went so quickly. They let me do it because I was on my way to South Africa. And this is what they said. We know the problems there are as bad as ours. And if anything you learn here will help there, we would like to help. So they had a global view, and they were dealing with local issues. And they saw the international support as important, but it all came out of the interaction with their facilitators. The facilitators had the skills of reading and writing, but they didn't know the local story. The way they learned to read so fast is, the words they learned, and in the system you learn about 17 words, never more than that. You make them into statements. The facilitator makes the sentences and goes out and picks pictures in the town to describe the sentences, just the way if you would do it writing a reader, you would do. But then he brings it back, or she brings it back, and the people who are learning to read correct the sentences. They say, no, that's not what it means. You should have said it this way. We don't use that word. This is the word we use. So they began putting it into their own language, their own words. And the pictures, they then went out and got the right pictures to go with the words, so that the facilitator was both teacher and learner, and the people were teachers and learner. And the process of conscientization is a learning, teaching experience. And it isn't that some pedagogue out there discovered this. They discovered it in the doing. Now, I know the word pedagogy means teaching children, but we are always teaching children. Some people want to turn it into another word that's another Greek word that would be more sophisticated and we wouldn't know its meaning. Pedagogy is a good word because all our teaching is really teaching children because they're watching us all the time. All right, now, the problem with conscientization is it fascinates us. It's the style in universities in the United States at the present time to teach Paulo Freire, to teach about him and teach the method. But the fact is it was never intended for universities, and when you use it there, you exploit it. Because we all can experience oppressions, but it isn't about our oppressions. It's the oppressions of the poor. Now, I'll define poor as people with high infant mortality and low life expectancy. So don't ask me what I mean by the poor. That's what I mean by the poor. I mean, you can ask me if you want to, but that's what the definition will be. If it's hard to stay alive and you don't live very long, you're poor. Now, the problem with using this method is that it works very well if the government likes it. And if the government doesn't like it, it's extremely dangerous. So dangerous that in Brazil, in 1964, when it had been in operations from 1958, it was working so well that the first thing that the military coup did, that took over the government in 1964, was to exile Paulo Freire and introduce a program that looked just like it, only it was called alphabetization. And the government provided the pictures, and the stories were about the national sport, about Brasilia, the capital, about the songs of Brazil. So that it indoctrinated instead of leading out. The other problem, so that's how dangerous it is. Paulo Freire, just to bring him up to date, he then went to Chile. He taught there for a few years. Now think of 64. Think of what went on in Chile. Then he went from Chile, when he was exiled there, he came, of all places, to the School of Education at Harvard University for a year. That's where I met him. He found that the hardest year of his life in teaching, because he was teaching the non-poor, and he didn't have anything for the non-poor. So he went from there to the World Council of Churches, and he worked with the people in Guinea-Bissau. Now, what happened in Guinea-Bissau? Guinea-Bissau got its independence, and then it's had problems since. And then he worked on programs for conscientization for Southern Africa. He has just recently retired. He's been invited back to Brazil. He's living there now. And if all goes well, he's going to join us in November with the Plowshares Institute and do some, I hope, critical analysis of our efforts of a pedagogy for the non-poor. So now I've come to that. What's the difference? Well, the pedagogy of the non-poor assumes that we take the gospel seriously, that we affirm that the land belongs to the people, the land that just fell down, that when the poor hear the good news, that the gospel mandates them to reach out and take what is rightfully theirs. So the question becomes, when the poor reach out to take what is rightfully theirs, what further does the gospel mandate the non-poor to do? And that's the question we're looking at. Now, I hypothesize with a number of our sisters that the gospel mandates us to take our grasp off the things the poor need in order to survive. Now, why is it formulated that way? Because in Brazil, prior to the peasants learning how to read and write, people said, they're ignorant, illiterate, irresponsible. We have to help them because they can't help themselves. As soon as they helped themselves and did it effectively, we tried to take the tools of helping away from them. So we really didn't mean what we said before, because when they did it, we resisted them. We find this happens all around the world. I brought a story that the poor had published in the Boston Globe. It's called No More Double Talk. It's Goodbye Columbia Point. Now, any of you who know Boston know that this is our biggest housing project. It began in the early 50s. I was just beginning to teach college at that time. And so one of the first projects I did was interview all the people who lived in Columbia Point, where our students did it, about living there. And the phenomenal thing about it, it's out over the ocean by Boston Harbor. It's a very, very high-rise set of apartments. There was nothing else out there when we went. There were no churches. There were no stores. There were no schools. There was no bus line. So people walked from Columbia Point over to South Boston to go to the store. You could go around the edge and went to the store there, but it was miles. Or they walked into Dorchester. They had to walk a couple of miles to go to school. Gradually, they brought things out there, but nothing in comparison with what was needed. A Catholic church was built, and a friend of mine who was Baptist told me she was the first black family at Columbia Point. And her family actually became Catholic simply so they could go to church on Sunday because there wasn't any other place to go. And I just want to point out what was there. Now, what's out on Columbia Point? The University of Massachusetts at Boston and the Kennedy Library. That's all that's out there besides this high rise. Now, what this story tells you, and if there were time today, I would read it, is that when it began, when the project began, that's when I interviewed there, there were spaces for, I think it's 4,000 families. There are now 350 families living there. When it began, it was all white. Now it's all black and Spanish speaking. But in 1972, there were still 1,242 families there. And what happened to it? It is one of the most valuable pieces of land in the whole of the United States. If you remember, the housing project, that land, was loaned for 40 years. It was to get over the hump of the Depression that we couldn't solve. So that land now can be sold to private developers. And what this account tells us is that it's going to go for the most expensive kind of housing. And with all the organizing that the poor could do there, with every bit of effort they had, all they could do was get a tentative guarantee that they would let the poor that are there now stay, up to 400, but no more. And they wouldn't even do that if there wasn't some housing subsidy from the government. So this is a city group of people organizing and claiming their land and getting their resistance from the non-poor, the people who would like to live on the land that's theirs. And in this little booklet that we use in doing the pedagogy project, we have five stories. It opens with five stories of other people in foreign lands and in different parts of the United States, who are poor, who organized themselves the way the Northeast Brazilians did, reached out to take their land, and the non-poor took it, held it, kept it from them. But the non-poor belonged to the same religious groups, went to the same kinds of churches, but in different areas, because the church was separate out in the suburbs, or the suburbs had captured the churches. So in a church perspective, When you do conscientization, you come back. Our sisters come back from all over the world and tell us there's something we've got to do with the non-poor that we're not doing because they seem to think they have the rights to this land which is ours. So we said, well, what we need then is a pedagogy of the non-poor. And that's what our project is about. We only know a little bit about it. So what it is, we have started a project internationally. When I say we, I mean some Sisters of Notre Dame that belong to the same group I belong to. Now in New Zealand, some Anglicans, some Presbyterians, and some Methodists. In Australia, some people of the same groups, because I just happened to go there the summer before last and talked in many places, and people said, yes, we would like to try that. We have some people in Scotland, in Brazil, in Kenya, Nigeria, Italy, different parts of the United States. And we've asked them to do this, to try this method that we put together in a first working paper and write to us and tell us what happened. Because we have a feeling that when you begin to teach the non-poor what in biblical reflection we've come to see as what they're asked to do, There's a resistance at first, but there's also an excitement about the possibilities. Excitement comes from the reality of the size of the world population and the resources. And I'm not going to talk about this afternoon. I'm going to talk about this tomorrow morning. But the result is the reality that we have here. If you just look at this map. Now, discount those white spots at the top, which are water. This is a picture. The dark red is the overfed world, and the light red is the underfed world. Now, when you're hungry, you have to reach out because you have to survive. You have to struggle for your existence. So this is the other quiz question. And the question is, what is the are the real conflict areas of the world? And the choice was north, south, and east, west. So how many chose north, south? Now that one, that's about half. Now you can see where the problem lies. This is the world's consumption of grain. Now, over on the wall, and I left it by the door so you could look at it on the way out. That is the Population Reference Bureau's chart of the distribution of some of the resources of the world. Every country's there, so you can look at your favorite country. And it also has one second last column, tells you the number of people in the world per square kilometer of arable land. That sounds awful. But what it means is the number of people that the world, the resources that we have now for growing what we feed ourselves with, clothe ourselves with, house ourselves with, the resources that we have. And what it tells you is, I think, that there are 58 people per square kilometer of arable land in the world. That means that's not many people. Those of you that work with land know that. So that it means that we have an enormous resource of materials in relationship to the size of the world population for providing resources for the peoples of the world. Now, I know this is controversial, so be ready to attack me in any way you want. I shall stand up here like a martyr and receive every single arrow. But remember, I'm a sociologist, and I wouldn't dare open my mouth if I didn't have any data. But it may not be any good, because you know, you can quote statistics all kinds of ways. You know that better than I do. Well, in any event, when I look at the map, oh, excuse me, it's 98 people per square kilometer of arable land in the world. Now, you know how we've said we can't let in all these people from Southeast Asia who are coming over here when they have their political problems, when they have their economic problems, because there won't be any room for us. We'll be wall-to-wall people. That's usually what we say. Well, the United States is 58 people per square kilometer of arable land. Australia is 10. Not land, but arable land. The land that you can actually use. And New Zealand is 3. But when I look at New Zealand and Australia and the United States immigration rules, they're almost exactly the same. That is, people who are white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant are welcome. And most of the other people are not. I just use the word WASP as we speak of it on the East Coast. I just made myself vulnerable again. Now, what does that mean? It means that in some sense, that map of the world with all the people on it and the land mass that was once all one mass is not in our consciousness that way. That there are people whom we would prefer to have living on our land space next door to us in our town that we feel ought to come, so we make laws that they can come. And we make laws that other people can come. And when we look at those laws, they are directly related to the parts of the world that are overcrowded. That is, where there are more people. For example, in Hong Kong, there are 68,000 people per square kilometer of arable land. So if you look at the map, I mean the chart, you'll find that almost invariably, the people who don't need to come, we let come. And the people who would need to come because the land is more crowded, we exclude them. However, they come anyway. So the problem is, how do we teach ourselves in such a way that we can effectively share our resources. So that's the first problem. But there's a problem prior to that, and that is, why do we bother doing it? Why should we share our resources with the people of the earth? Now, I'm going to stop there for a moment and say, well, why should we? Or should we? Or should we be practical and protect our progeny? But who are our progeny? I'm open to some suggestions.
One that I find it rather difficult because in our country, because most people are not looking at it in this more sensible way, they always think in terms of sharing resources as giving something to someone rather than sharing their land by allowing them to immigrate and such. And what are some ideas that, you know, educating the pedagogy to away from this notion that we're giving something away rather than people earning it by emigrating here, earning, living, this type of thing, or in some other way dealing with it with their economies within their own country, sharing their economy or something.
Right. That's an important question. So one thing we say, when we look biblically, it looks as though analysis after analysis is announcing that the land belongs to all these people. Fortunately, you have an opportunity all this week to study this biblically, because the morning session is really dealing with this question directly. So that leaves us with a challenge, because we have a dilemma, and the dilemma is the good news announces that food, clothing, and shelter are to be given to the poor. Now, symbolically, those are defined as the widows and the orphans. And the reason that's done that way biblically is that those were the only people that were not cared for in the early world, because we lived in extended kinship systems, and the children belonged to the community. All the children belonged to the community. But widows and orphans had no immediate family. So other families that were more distantly related to them had to take care of them. But always it says that's our first mandate, to take care of the widows or orphans, which would mean the poor in our midst, and the sojourner, mean the poor who are on the road, working, moving through, the pilgrims. All right, so that means everybody, the people who come and the people who are there. Now that's the announcement. We pick up that good news, and it says so many other things that are attractive. We take up this agenda too, not realizing what it's going to call us to do. Now my thesis tomorrow morning and evening is going to be that biblical mandate is asking something radically different of us in the mid-20th century from anything we organized and planned to do in the past. That it's simply putting a new agenda on us. So I've called it, with the group I work with, which is an international group of people who work with poor people, who keep pressuring me, the gospel agenda in global perspective. As a sociologist, my commitment, my missionary commitment, is to do science for the people. See, I think we have to become superb scientists, social scientists, educators, philosophers, culture analysts, and culture makers, committed to this agenda. Many, many people have taken it up already because our churches have invited us to do it. And I'm going to do the churches before we do the gospel agenda, because the gospel agenda is in process. And what the churches are doing is making us so mad. But in fact, when we get together as church and define ourselves as the assembly of the faithful, we do some remarkably good things if we meet internationally and cross-class. But when we meet by class and nationally, we mess the church up. Because the church was never intended to be either an ethnic church or a class church. But we built our churches and forced them to become that, and we put blinders on ourselves. So that we were convinced within our local church that we were doing the best we could, because we took care of the poor we saw. But in a wealthy or a middle-class neighborhood, you seldom see the poor because they can't afford to go there, even to get on a streetcar in Boston and go anyplace, now cost a dollar and a half. And by the way, that's how we're moving the poor out of the city, because we make the car fare too much for them to move from place to place. And we're taking over the city with the condominiums. So the churches, and I'll do the Catholic Church first because I can do it better. I know it better, I belong to it. And then I'll do the World Council of Churches just briefly, but you're going to get some real good agenda on that. Everything we're saying, we have some more of it that's better than what we've already said. So, I mean, more evidential, but you have to kind of move into it. Well, I didn't bring all of these documents today, but I will tomorrow. In 1891, the church could not keep any longer from hearing what the socialists of the 19th century were saying to them. And what they were saying, first the Christian socialists, then the agrarian socialists, then the Marxist socialists, in that order, were saying that the land belongs to the people. And if we turn the land into an industrial system, it still belongs to them. So by reason of their labor on the land, they own it by reason of their labor. That was the socialist theme. Well, it trickled in finally into the Catholic Church in 1891. So Pope Leo wrote a document called Rerum Novarum. We always did everything in Latin in those days. And the English title of that was On the Conditions of the Working Class. The thesis was that the laborer has a right to a wage sufficiently large for himself and his family to live in simple dignity. We still thought at that time that heads of households were always men. So it was done that way. But in 1931, at the height of the Depression, that theme was not sufficiently operative in the local churches. And so another document was written by, this was Pope Pius XI, and it was called Quadragesimo Anno, so they would know that it was 40 years after the first one. Quadragesimo Anno, 40 years later. But the English title was On the Reconstruction of the Social Order. Well, you don't reconstruct something that's already well done. I mean, you couldn't afford to. The social order means the political economy and the class structure. So what he said, it needs to be reconstructed because the workers are not getting access to the resources. So he repeated what Leo had said and then added, and the worker has a right to the strike and the boycott in order to effectively organize to be sufficiently powerful to encounter management. That was 1931. That's when all the labor management schools began and the Catholics moved into labor organizing in great enthusiasm, and with some wisdom and some non-wisdom. 1961, Mater et Magistra came out. Now that the English title of that is Christianity and Social Progress. And that was Pope John the 23rd, and he was a peasant himself. And it was addressed specifically to Latin America. And what it said, this is a Christian Catholic continent, and the church is so tightly aligned with established powers that the 90% of the population that's poor is exploited, and that's a violation of the gospel. At that time, William Buckley wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal, an editorial, Mater si, Magistra no. I will take the church as my mother and take care of her, but not as my teacher because I know more about the political order than the church does. 1971, the 80th year letter. That's the name of it. So we have no doubt what it meant. 40 years after Rerum Novarum is the subtitle. But the dominant title is A Call to Action. And the thesis is, now that the multinational corporations are no longer under the control of any sovereign state, it mandates the committed Christian to move into political action and transform the society to bring it into line with Christian values. To transform the political order, the social order, the cultural order. Now I'll finish off this story. 1981, the 90th year letter is called Laborum Exercens, on the conditions of labor. And the thesis is, the working class. And the thesis is, very simply, a worker comes to ownership through working.
Now, it sounds very much like socialism. And we have to think about that today. In between that, Parchment Terrace came out in 1963. And when we do the human rights in more detail, we'll see this document is the same as the human rights document in its context. And its thesis is that peace, poverty, and human rights are the agenda of the committed Christian. And this one came out in 1971, and the bishops of the world met to try to implement the call to action. Now, what was the rest of the Christian world doing during that time? Just so you know that the churches were assisting the United Nations in developing and completing the human rights documents. In the middle 70s, Church Alert came out. Now, I don't know whether you know this journal, but it's published jointly by the Pontifical Commission on Justice and Peace of the Holy See and the Justice and Service of the World Council of Churches. And they reviewed in the 1977 and 1978 issues. I just brought one of each because that's all that would fit in my suitcase. But there are four of them altogether, four more. All the work that the World Council of Churches and the Catholic Church have done on bringing the justice agenda of the non-poor into line with the gospel from 1891 through 1975, about, I think it goes that. And it's called the Rapa de Papa Colloquium on the Social Thinking of the Churches. And the articles are done by a variety of people. And one last point. In 1980, the World Council of Churches published Ecumenism in a New World Order, the Failure of the 1970s and the Challenges of 1980, and Transnational Corporations, Technology and Human Development. And the author is a Latin American. I think I'm right. Is that correct? Marcus Aruda? Now that, you know what happened when this occurred. What did the, you probably know that Pope John the 23rd was defined as a poor old man who had become the dupe of communists. And if you recall what happened to the World Council of Churches this year, these people said, that's a communist organization, or it's too soft on communism. What did communism mean? It meant taking seriously the social agenda of the churches. And I know that that association was made because I used to give a quiz with content out of these documents and ask audiences who said these things. And invariably, I even gave it to 40 bishops at one time. And I said, Karl Marx. So that's what the churches are trying to do. Now, I haven't answered the question, what are the biblical roots of that? But we will get to that. Because what we're arguing is that the good news is in the gospel. The task is, how do you do it joyfully? And my thesis is, you do it joyfully because it's a feasible, it's a technical problem that has a solution. But we didn't know that until 1980.
Could you repeat that? You said it's a technical
problem. I said it's a technical problem that has a solution. But we didn't know that until 1980.
Why don't you elaborate? Can you elaborate on what you mean by that?
I'll just do it a little tiny bit, because it needs a lot, and I'm going to do it tomorrow night. We've been very worried since 1950 that there were too many people in the world. And if you heard James Wilson last night, except for that the numbers were a little bit off, he said that really isn't the problem. The problem is not that we're running out of resources. I will quote one person, Roger Revelle, who is the retired head of the Population Bureau at Harvard University, argues that the carrying capacity of the world, the resources, the materials we have to make food, clothing, and housing out of, is 35 billion people. Now, Nathan Kafitz, who teaches in exactly the same department as Roger Revelle, says it's between 6 and 8. Billion. Jean Maher, who is the president of Tufts University, you notice how local I am. I never moved more than 50 miles around Boston. Because after all, I lived in the same house for four generations. I didn't do it, but we did. And after all, Harvard University never gives never gives grants to go to meetings on the argument that anything that's worth saying happens no further away than New York. And you can afford to take yourself that far yourself. I'm sure. I didn't mean it this way. I want to say
I think I know what you're saying now.
What I'm saying is there is substantial data for us to look at that demonstrates that the relationship between the resources in the world and the population of the world is a solvable problem. I didn't say how, but I'm saying there's overwhelming evidence that it's a solvable problem. But in the 1950s, we thought it was an unsolvable problem. And so thinking it was an unsolvable problem, and we had lots of pressures to think so, because we hadn't yet committed ourselves as scientists to the people. We were still committing ourselves as scientists to the corporation because that's where the high salaries were. And now we find there's no sense in having a high salary if the world isn't going to be here. So you'd better work for the people. But that time, because we thought it was an unsolvable problem with no technical solution, we developed an ethics of dying gracefully. So we have much more on the theology of dying than on the theology of living.
Do you find that it's at this point in the logical the progression after that assumption is when you get people the most angry, because what you're saying then is that there has to be a reordering of the world economic order.
Yes, but they get angry usually because first they haven't seen that the problem is feasible. Mm-hmm. Most of us live secretly with the fear that they are going to overwhelm us, whoever they are. And what I am going to argue is they are not going to overwhelm us, and we need them. And I'm not going to argue that from the Bible. I'm going to argue that from the information of my discipline. Therefore, you come with all the information from your disciplines and challenge me. And I hope I can hold my own. Not just so, I want to demonstrate something. If I'm wrong, I want to know it. Because I don't want to go on with this project if, in fact, it isn't good news. Now, who pushes me to do this project? The only people who push me, and they push me all the while, are people who are poor, who have heard the good news of the gospel, have organized themselves, have learned to read and write, have taken exactly what we told them to do, to take the initiative, to pull themselves up from their bootstraps, and they do that. They can get an understanding of the question, they can get themselves ready to do the action, but they don't have weapons. Because they don't have weapons, they get killed. Now, why are there so many weapons around? Because that was the best solution we could think to this of solving this unsolvable problem. And I will just picture that the way it looks from that perspective. We will join the nuclear freeze movement, and we should. And we join it because we clearly see, by counting the number of weapons, that we're all going to get killed if they're used. But what we often don't see is that if we keep the neat balance and the control, we won't have a nuclear war, but we will have many small wars, and we are having many small wars. And by focusing on the nuclear problem, we let the war go on, continue in Central America, we let it continue in Southeast Asia, we let it continue in Northern Ireland. We let it continue in the Middle East because we're afraid not to let it continue for fear it will grow into this war that we'll be involved in. And my thesis is that that nuclear setup is our way of setting up to keep on using the resources of the third world, which they need in order to survive.
We become sensitive to the nuclear freeze, the world situation, the global problem. And a lot of us have worked a long time at doing it, you know. Spend a lot of time, you know, maybe one night a week, for maybe several years. And we start looking for direction, for something to really do. And you talk about being angry. The more I hear, the more I feel very angry about a lot of intellectual lines about what is happening and what's going on in different ways of saying the same thing over and over. We end up powerless in this country, ourselves, each citizen, because our country does, our leaders don't listen to us. When do we find an organization to help each one of us to have the power that we have?
Okay, now, this is the right question. Now, I think one of the reasons we end up powerless is that the basic information, the information on what we on which we ground our evidence, is slippery. And I want to demonstrate tomorrow morning that the basic information is not slippery, and that you're not going to like forget or get something different next week. And the reason I put the Population Reference Bureau material on the wall, it's going to be population information. But they prepare materials, that organization, that you can use from first graders right up through the most sophisticated group. And it's the same information. Now, I've been following it year for year from 1963, every single year. That means for the last 20 years, I've been tracing the population data, the infant mortality rate, the death rates, the GNPs, the relationship between those and what people have. Now, that's number one. Until there was an effective pedagogy for the poor, I didn't want to teach anything to the non-poor. Because whatever we learn, we use. Now, I feel we do have an internationally effective method that the poor use. And it gives them real leverage. Now, they are my primary concern. Now that I know that they can organize effectively, that they can learn to read and write, and now that I know, like from our missions in Zaire, we've been in the Congo since, the former Congo, since the 19th century. We've been in what was Rhodesia since 1898. We've been in South Africa since 1892. And in some of our places in South Africa, in some of those areas, we have people now who don't know the language of the poor. They did know it when they first went. They empowered the poor, but they didn't have any methods. Now they have the method, and you can't do it without the language. And so I want to set that thing in place. The poor know they have means of organizing. It's just dangerous for them to do it. So now we can take up the agenda that you're asking. We do have methods that are good, and you do need to join organizations. And Plowshares might be one of the groups that gives that more and more agenda. But what I want to say is that ordinary people, we have found, can do exactly what I'm doing and can teach their children. Once children know the reality of the world they live in, which they do not know from our textbooks, they knew the reality better in the 50s than they know it now. Our textbook companies, for the most part, are now segments of multinational corporations. They weren't before, they were independent. You used to be able to get information from the newspaper because you had a Democratic and a Republican newspaper, and so what one group didn't tell you, the other group did tell you in order to transfer power. We don't have those anymore. But now, we can go to school, we all can, learn journalism, get our Christian commitment, and act in the interests of people. You come here, not just because it's a lovely place to come, I've discovered, but to learn how to live with a community of people who have common interests with you, so when things get messed up, you can keep on going. But this is happening all over the world. These things are really happening. Now, the critical question, and this is one we probably don't yet have consensus on, what kind of world do we opt for? Now, somebody who's here, I think it's Jenny. Now, she's going to move right in on talking about a new international economic order tomorrow or Saturday. Our two sessions were set up at the same time. We felt that was a problem. I don't even know her yet, but I know what she's talking about. Because you ought to hear both of them. And you ought to hear them from a different perspective. So we think we've arranged something that's going to happen, that they're not mixed up.